As we've already said this morning, this faith that we have, if it doesn't work in the tough times, in the difficult times, does it really work at all? And of course, our own Saviour, Jesus Christ, as he went to the cross, he went in faith. And yet even for him, there was that time, that moment when he said, if only this cup of suffering could pass over from me. Moses, the man of faith, said to God, please send someone else. And yet God is calling each one of us to live for him in the situation where we are uniquely planted today. And if you look around the church, there is no one that is going through what you are going through this morning. No one else in this church has that unique set of circumstances that you have. And if faith works for them, maybe faith can work for you too. Our sermon this morning, we're going to be looking at three occasions where Jesus predicted his death and his resurrection. And as we start, I want to ask you, how do you respond to bad news? And how do you respond to good news? How did the disciples respond when Jesus predicted his death and resurrection? Was that bad news? Predicting his death and resurrection? Was that good news? Or was it a mixture of both? Did they understand what Jesus was saying when he told them that he would be killed, murdered, and rise from the dead? Did they understand what Jesus was saying? Did they understand the purposes of God? Did they understand the plans of God? Did they understand the priorities of God? Because you see, when Jesus said in the Garden of Gethsemane, but not my will, but yours be done, he was focusing on the purposes of God, the plans of God, and the priorities of God. As you can see, we're having trouble with our slides this morning, but the next slide, if it was there, would have the word on it, rebuke. Because I'm going to look at three responses that the disciples made when they heard from Jesus that he was going to die and rise again. So we're in Matthew chapter 16 and verse 13 to 28. And imagine that you can see the slide and there's the word there, rebuke, on the slide. Matthew 16 and verse 13 to 28. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" And they replied, "Some say John the Baptist, some say Elijah, and still others, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." And as we enter into this passage, you'll notice Jesus uses a very humble title about himself. He is living God, he is creator of everything, and yet he refers to himself as the Son of Man. Who do people say the Son of Man is? And that's an interesting question for us here. What do people around you, in your workplace, in your neighborhood, in your college, your university, wherever you are, what do people say about Jesus. What do people say about Jesus today? But you know what? Jesus moves on to the next question, verse 15, and he says, but what about you? Who do you say that I am? Because, you know, in a sense, it doesn't really matter what everyone else is saying about Jesus. It matters what you're saying about Jesus, because faith and relationship with God has to be a personal thing. We all come to Jesus as individuals. We cannot come as a group. Okay, we come as a group to worship on a Sunday and in our house groups and so on. But actually, Jesus is asking us this morning, what do you say about me? Who do you say that I am? And Simon Peter answers in the next verse, verse 16, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. This word Messiah, Christ, anointed one. Peter says, you are the Messiah. You are the Christ. You are the anointed one. You are the one that we have been waiting centuries for. And Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. I don't know if you've noticed the way schools behave and the way parents behave today compared to when we were kids. When we were kids, you got told off for everything. You got told off by parents, by grandparents, by teachers, and by neighbors. Is that true? It is true. What do parents and grandparents and teachers and neighbors do nowadays with children? Do they tell them off? No. What do? They say, well done. Congratulations. You're so clever. You're so amazing. Is there a sense that they got it wrong in my generation? Maybe. Is there a sense they've got it wrong in our generation today? Maybe. But what you notice here is that when Peter gets the right answer, Jesus doesn't say, well done, congratulations, you're so clever. What does Jesus say instead? He says, you've been blessed. You've been blessed. Why have you been blessed? Because this was not revealed to you by your own strength and energy and flesh and blood. No, this was revealed to you by God the Father, God my Father who is in heaven. Michael, we loved the way you led this morning. Thank you. Congratulations. Well done. But more than that, we're so blessed because you've been blessed by what God has put inside of you, in your heart and in the fiber of your being. Thanks be to God. We need to ask ourselves the question, do we need to pray for a fresh revelation of who Jesus is? Do we? I think we do. Because Simon Peter had it revealed to him. We need a fresh revelation of who Jesus is. And then Jesus goes on to say in verse 18, I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. Do you love church, my friends? Give me a nod if you love church. Do you love our church? Real church is Jesus' church. There's only one church. It's Jesus' church. And Jesus says, I will build my church. He goes on to say, I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Then he ordered his disciples not to tell anyone who he was, not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. Here's a very interesting point to note, yes? God has revealed to Peter in a supernatural way that Jesus is Messiah. And Jesus tells Peter, you've been blessed because of this revelation. He also says to the disciples, don't tell anyone yet. Don't tell anyone yet. And now we get to the the actual prediction that Jesus makes of his death and resurrection. Verse 21 says, from that time on. From that time on, Jesus started to predict his death and resurrection. From what time on? From the time that Peter had declared, you are the Christ. You are the Messiah. You are the chosen one. You are the one we've been waiting for. From that time on, Jesus started to declare that he was going to be crucified and rise from the dead. But here's the thing, you see. Peter has declared, you are the Messiah. You're the one we've been waiting for. You're the one even that our Jewish hierarchy has been waiting for. You're the one that the high priests and the Pharisees and so on, you're the one that we've all been waiting for. Now Jesus goes on to say, okay, you've got it that I'm the one you've been waiting for, but now I'm going to tell you what kind of person I'm going to be. You've been waiting for Messiah, but what does that actually mean? You've been waiting for Christ. You've been waiting for the Anointed One. But what will that actually mean? Are you expecting me to be like David, who went out physically fighting people with battles? Or is something else happening? Jesus began to explain to his disciples, verse 21, that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders and the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day raised to life. I don't know if you noticed that section there is just one sentence. Just one sentence. Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, comma, the chief priests and the teachers of the law, comma, and that he must be killed and on the third day raised to life, full stop. What a long sentence. What a huge amount for us to grasp. But we do have the benefits of hindsight, and we have heard this message before. Whereas, of course, for the disciples, this is the first time they've heard it. And how did the disciples respond? What did Peter do? Look at the next verse with me, please. Peter took Jesus aside and began to rebuke Jesus. Peter began to rebuke the living God, the one who had created humanity. He began to rebuke the living God, the one who had revealed to him that Jesus is the Christ. Peter began to rebuke Jesus and said, never, Lord, this shall never happen to you. Never, Lord, this shall never happen to you. And what you notice and what is interesting is that Peter rebukes Jesus and then Jesus rebukes Peter. Or perhaps more correctly, Jesus rebukes Satan, who is living and operating within Peter, and yet we've just been told that the revelation that Jesus is Messiah has come from God the Father in heaven. Do you get it, my friends? That God the Father is revealing things within Peter, and Satan is working within Peter. And some of you, and sometimes me also, we wonder, why do we struggle as believers? Why do we find it so hard? The voice inside says, love, bless, forgive, go out, pour out. But there's another voice inside that says, hate, hold resentment. Hang on to those poor old me sentiments. Peter took Jesus aside and said, rebuked him, saying, never, Lord, this shall never happen to you. But look at verse 23. Jesus then turned to Peter and said, get behind me, Satan. Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. Jesus rebuked Peter, or should we say Jesus rebuked Satan that was operating within Peter, seeking to influence Jesus. And of course, if Jesus had listened to Peter and taken to heart, he would not have gone to the cross. He would not even have got to the Garden of Gethsemane and the "not my will but yours be done" conversation. He wouldn't even have got there. Jesus turned and said to Peter, verse 23, "Get behind me, Satan, you are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." And then Jesus said to his disciples, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me." Do you get it? This is the gospel. Anyone who wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow Jesus. What do we call this gospel? Is it called the prosperity gospel? Is it called an easy gospel? Is it what we refer to as a sleekly marketed gospel? Is this a comfortable gospel? No, my friends, my brothers, my sisters, this is a costly gospel. This is the authentic gospel. And Jesus goes on to say in verse 25, "For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it." And Jesus asks the question, what good will it do for someone to gain the whole world and yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? Peter had been expecting a this worldly Messiah, but Jesus' kingdom is, of course, not of this world. And Jesus goes on to say, verse 27, "For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will reward each person according to what they have done. Truly I tell you, some who are here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." When we look at the gospel and when we look at our own lives too and our own walk of faith, we must see the big picture and the full picture. Because if we only focus on the suffering, we will fall into depression and distress and despair. Jesus is saying here that he will die in humility, but he will rise in victory and he will return in glory. My friends, my brothers and sisters, just on Wednesday at the house group, we were looking at the subject of the Antichrist. And that's exactly what I said when we started looking at the subject of the Antichrist. We must see the big picture, because if we only focus on one little tiny detail, we will become so distressed and so depressed. You know, we've got to hold on to the big picture. Let's move to our next slide, please. And thank you, Nevin, for getting them up there. The next slide, oh, it's there, grief. The next slide is grief. Okay, as I say, if you do not see the big picture, you risk becoming depressed and becoming filled with grief. And that is exactly what happens to the disciples in the next second declaration of Jesus going to the cross. So we're in Matthew 17 now. Matthew 17, verse 22. "When they came together in Galilee, Jesus said to them, 'The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. They will kill him, and on the third day he will be raised to life.' And the disciples were filled with grief." And what it seems here is that they heard the first part, but they didn't hear the second part. They don't ask questions how and why and when and so on. They just focus on the fact that Jesus is going to be killed. They don't even hear that he's going to rise from the dead. They don't even ask about that. They don't get excited about what's happening after the first phase. They just focus on the first phase and they are filled with grief. It's interesting here, Jesus uses again the term the Son of Man. Verse 22, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men. Do you see that? The Son of Man, but the one who created everything, who created humanity, the one who was there when the first man was formed out of dust of the earth, this God will be handed over to man. The one who made man will be handed over to man. God, who became a Son of Man, will be delivered into the hands of men. Is this good news? Is this bad news? Is there a double aspect to it? We have to understand the big picture. They were told, Jesus told them, they will kill me. Did they get it? Yes, they did. And on the third day, he will be raised to life. Did they get it? I'm not sure they did, not at that moment. And the disciples were filled with grief. Let's move to our third slide, please. The third response. What was the first response? What was the first response? We didn't have a slide. The first response. Say it again. The first response was rebuke. The second response was grief. And now the third response, can you believe it? A request. So we're now in Matthew 20, verse 17. Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, and on the way he took the 12 aside and he spoke to them. Just a note as we move into the text, he's still speaking to the inner circle. He's speaking to the 12 disciples. He's not talking to everyone. And now verse 18, he says, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. And on the third day, he will be raised to life. Interesting, in verse 18, we're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. These chief priests and these teachers of the law were supposed to be the servants of the living God. They were supposed to be the priests of the living God. They were supposed to be teaching the next generation about the plans and the purposes and the priorities of God. But Jesus was going to be put into their hands. They will condemn him to death. They will hand him over to the Gentiles. Those who were supposed to be protecting the nation of God and protecting the structure of the nation of God were going to hand the living God over to a people who were not even part of the nation of God. They were going to hand Jesus over to the nations, to the Gentiles. And they were going to do so such that he would be mocked, he would be flogged, and he would be crucified. But, Jesus says, on the third day, he will be raised to life. So we have to say in this third prediction, awful as it will be, that Jesus will be mocked and flogged and crucified, handed over to the Gentiles, it will result in resurrection. Is this good news? Is this bad news? Is this difficult news? Let me ask you a question. If you had been there, if you had been one of the disciples, would you have had some questions for Jesus at this point? Would you have wanted some more information? What are you talking about, Lord? Help us to understand this, Lord. What do you mean? How did the disciples respond to this third declaration by Jesus? That he will be killed and then raised from the dead. What did they say to Jesus on this subject? What did they say? Nothing. Zero. Nil. Zilch. Or as we Romanians say, nimic. Nimic. They don't say anything about what Jesus has been saying to them about his death and his resurrection. And instead, two of them and their mum asked Jesus for a favour. If you look ahead in the passage, you'll see that. None of them asked Jesus about his suffering and what it means and what's going to happen. None of them asked for more details. Instead, two of them, two brothers, and their mum asked Jesus for a favour. Maybe they had misunderstood what Jesus was saying to them. Maybe they had misunderstood what Messiah would be. Maybe they had misunderstood what gospel would be. Maybe, my friends, they were the first to think of the gospel as a prosperity gospel, because they asked Jesus for a favour, and the favour had to do with prosperity. Do you believe me? Let's look at the next verse. Verse 20. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and, kneeling down, asked a favour of him. She said, and Jesus responded by saying, "What is it you want?" And then the mother replied, "Grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom." Do you understand what's going on, my friends? They have just been told the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death. They will hand him over to the Gentiles to be mocked and flogged and crucified. And on the third day, he will be raised to life. And all that these two brothers and their mum can think of is personal prosperity. What was Jesus' response? Jesus said, "You don't know what you are asking. Can you drink the cup I am going to drink?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared by my Father." And when the other ten disciples heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers. Isn't that always the way? When we step out of line, when we step out of the calling of God and we want for ourselves, it not only affects our relationship with God, it also reflects our relationship with each other. We're going to be celebrating the bread and the wine in just a moment. We talk about the cup of the suffering of the Lord. And of course, Jesus is making reference here in verse 22 and verse 23. "Can you drink the cup I'm going to drink?" He's talking about the fact that they will suffer for their faith. And yet, he makes it clear, Jesus isn't about to be handing out rewards at this point. In verse 24, we said, when the ten heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers. Verse 25, Jesus called them together and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must become your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave. What Jesus is saying here, and you can relate to this, so many times when there are things on the news and the government makes a decision, they do this or that. Just think back to the COVID times, for example, and the government is accused, and we say, you know, they make one rule for us and a different rule for everyone else. When they do things on tax and so on, they do one rule for them, another rule for us. The people that rule a nation just do it to line their own pockets. That's what Jesus is saying here. We see it in our own world today. And Jesus says, not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must become your servant. Whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Jesus is saying here that we must be so abnormal as we live by faith compared to the rest of the world. We must go so against the flow. We must be so unworldly, and we must be so otherworldly. That is, thinking about the kingdom that is to come. We must so seek the prosperity and well-being of others rather than our own. Because Jesus ends with these words in verse 28, just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give up his life as a ransom for many. Why did Jesus not come? He did not come to be served. Why did he come? He came to serve and to give up his life as a ransom for many. Amen.